Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Hello there, everybody in the universe. And I assume that it's not just planet Earth that's listening to this, but I'm sure there are other planets, other star systems out there which are somehow managing to tune in to episodes of Luke's English Podcast.
Well, because iTunes exists in those other planets now.
Yeah, why not? Why? Maybe we are being observed by alien life, and what they have done is they've invented incredibly advanced technology which allows them to tap into everything that happens on Earth. And the main reason, the focus of that is just so that they can download episodes of Luke's English Podcast.
Well, because like everyone else on planet Earth, you know, they also want to improve their English. So
yeah, exactly. Yes,
it's normal that people from Andromeda are
Alpha Centauri or wherever it is they're tuning in from, one of the moons of Jupiter or whatever. Yes, they too need to improve their English, so that when they eventually do come down, they'll be able to say, look, it's okay, put the guns away, we mean you no harm, take us to your leader. Maybe we should just give a little crash course for the aliens, how they should, you know, what they should be saying at the beginning, when they do, you know, try to make contact. What do you think, if we were to give some advice to aliens on how they should open a little communicative discourse with the people of Earth?
I think they should try to take a selfie with humankind. Like, I think that's kind of how they should buddy up with us. Okay. Like, hey, let's take a selfie together.
You think that would be the approach? The sort of like, hey,
I'm like one of you guys.
Yeah, it's like, I like your trainers. Let's take a selfie. Cheese. The peace sign.
Yeah, which is like two out of their three fingers.
Exactly, just trying to make a peace sign with just, you know, limited digits on the hand there. That's the approach. Yeah. And then just like, how would an alien strike up conversation with just a normal human? I don't know why I'm asking you this, Sebastian, because...
That's a very good question, though.
Have you ever thought about this before?
I think you kind of try to use like our language... But in a forced way, like as if they're just kind of reading from a translation of like Zark North into English dictionary.
Right.
You know, and just like saying things literally.
It's going to,
Just like, me content in you. You
know? Right. And they got no sense of irony or something.
None whatsoever.
Yeah. No ability to register humor.
Yeah, like as if they understood everything. They've been observing us for a long time. And they understand everything except humor.
They've been observing us for a long time, but they've just completely misunderstood almost all of the social interactions that they've seen. But they think that they know what it. They, you know, they think they've got it. So okay, we've got the humans now. Let's go and make contact. But they've completely. We were joking the entire time, aliens. Yeah. You didn't realize.
Right.
And they come down expecting, you know, the Earth to be a certain way. It's like, no, it's ironic. The Earth is a lot more ironic than. They imagine.
They take everything at face value. It's a. They don't like as if irony hasn't arrived in that planet.
Yeah. Yes. Well, anyway, if you are listening to this and you are from outer space, then do realize that sometimes humor is employed on Earth as a way of breaking the ice and just sort of like, you know,
bringing people together.
Exactly. It's a good way to just have a laugh at the ridiculousness of existence. And that means just having a bit of fun and telling a few jokes, right?
Yep.
Okay, so I was going to say on the subject of jokes, I'm joined today by my friend Sebastian Marx, a New Yorker in Paris, as he's known around here, because he does a one-man show every week in English and in French called A New Yorker in Paris. Is the French show also called A New Yorker in Paris?
No, it's called Un New Yorker à Paris.
Okay, which basically means A New Yorker in Paris if you don't speak French. So, obviously, Sebastian is a comic, not a comic book, but a person who performs comedy. Comedian or comedian. A comic?
I see both.
People do say comic for a person, don't they?
I think like if you're among comics, we say comic, but I think other people say comedian.
Right. Okay. Do you think comedian's got a slightly negative, maybe a slightly pejorative sense?
That's kind of why I don't like to use it.
Yeah.
I use it when I'm trying to like describe myself to someone else.
Yeah.
Outside of comedy, but I usually like to say comic, but I'm not sure why.
It's a bit
comedian
more...
sounds like a clown. Like there's a clown. Yeah.
It's like, what are you, some kind of comedian?
Exactly.
Yeah, it can be used as a put down, but a comic is just a bit more cool.
Yeah, it's more cool and sounds more professional.
A stand up is quite good as well.
Yeah,
but stand-up. I'd never say that I'm a stand up. I never say that.
I've never said that, and I don't think I will ever.
I always say, yeah, I do stand up. Not that I am a stand-up, but no, I do it.
I do it, yeah.
Because otherwise it just makes you sound like you're too big-headed or something.
Yeah.
Yes, anyway.
As if you are an art.
Yes, I am a
stand-up. I am film.
Yeah. So you do stand-up, and you've been on the podcast before.
Yes, I have.
Several times.
I think so.
Yeah.
We had tea. We were in Caen.
Yeah, exactly. So I brought you on the podcast. Okay, listeners. Do you know what my listeners are called? They have nicknames. The podcast is called Luke's English Podcast.
Yeah.
LEP. LEP. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, what would you call the people of LEP?
Lepers.
Lepers. Yeah. Exactly, yes.
And so have they gotten that joke? Or?
Yeah, they got the joke.
Okay.
Yeah, it took a little while. To be honest, the first time I described my listeners as lepers, it just sort of came up. It just sort of came out as I was trying to search for names for the listeners, and lepers appeared, and I riffed on it a little bit, but then I thought, no, I don't think anyone realizes that that's also the name of someone who has leprosy. And I was sort of, you know, it was like a sort of tongue-in-cheek thing at the beginning, and then people started to realize, and I got a comment from a regular listener who had just watched The Life of Brian.
Ah,
the Monty Python film.
Wonderful.
And there's a scene with a leper in it. And he
would
like
better. Who got better?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because he met Jesus.
Yeah.
Let's not go into the religious stuff, I guess. But anyway, he texted and he was like, you know, I just watched Monty Python. And what's this leper thing? So anyway, lepers or lepens or lepians or lepsters or
lepsters
is quite good. Yeah. Leperholics. There's you know. It's a bit like Mark Maron's thing, but, you know, pretty much the same kind of thing. Anyway, now, if you've listened to Sebastian on the podcast before, you will know that he's American. And I was thinking that since I've got an American, I haven't kidnapped
you. Yes, you've kidnapped me in my own home.
That's right. Sebastian invited me around and we had sushi and we've been talking and stuff. And so I thought, right, I want to know about America, because America is this thing that's present in the lives of lots of people who are not from the country, right? And, you know, obviously I grew up in the UK, in Europe, and we get lots and lots of American products and American culture and films. And it's, you know, like it's influenced our cultures a massive amount. So we get a certain sort of version of America, the kind of public image that you get in the Hollywood films and all that kind of thing. So America's, and also sort of America being the first economy for so many years, America's business affects business around the world. So America's business is sort of our business too. And I feel like America has taken on this idea also that the American struggle is also the world's struggle. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The idea that that somehow we're all rooting for America to succeed, and if it does, then it proves that this model of the capitalist sort of democracy works, and so we're all rooting for freedom and so on. So I wanted to know all about, you know, America, and get to know it in a bit more detail, so that we get beyond just the Hollywood version. And I thought, well, I can't ask everyone in America certain question. I can't ask everyone in America. So what I'm doing is going to ask one guy, and he's not even in America. So it may not be the most representative survey, but this episode of the podcast is going to be a sort of documentary interview with an American person, in order to just try and understand America in a bit more detail. Are you okay with that, Sebastian?
Oh, I feel lots of pressure.
Okay, you are expected now to sum up the whole ideology, to not just sum it up, but to also to justify it to the people of planet Earth. Okay?
Yeah.
America's on trial in this episode.
Yeah, and I'm the lawyer.
You're the attorney for America. Yeah. Exactly. And you have to sort of plead the case in a reasonable manner for America. And then the rest of the world will judge this, your country.
Based on my words tonight.
It's not quite as serious as that, of course. I think it's a fascinating subject because I've just spent a semester at the university dealing with this topic. And so it's, you know, something I've been considering. So just to make it extra difficult for you at the beginning, Sebastian, I'm going to ask you, how do you assess America's place in the world at this moment in time? Go.
Well, it's kind of, I want to talk about what you said before, why the States is kind of seen like the most important country, in the sense that we want the whole world to root for us, and what happens in the States, what happens in the world. It's because I feel like the United States sees itself as an experiment.
Yeah,
like
really?
An experiment of modern life.
Yeah.
In the sense that we identify ourselves as kind of the immigration country. And mm-hmm. so we represent the world. That's our
okay.
belief. That somehow we have the whole world represented. That people from all over the world came to the United States because they believed in a similar ideology.
Right.
And so all these people, I mean, this is, of course, very idealistic.
Yeah.
Idealistic to say, but like that the idea that everyone has a similar way of looking at the world, and so they all come to this continent, which is an open continent, which is, of course, totally false, because there were people living here, well, in the States before.
The Native Americans.
Exactly. Yeah. But that everyone coming there since is kind of like the world united in this similar project.
Right. Okay. Now, what is that project or that idea that
Well, I do think about? It's this idea of freedom and... freedom is the kind of the key word,
right?
But also that implies economic freedom, that okay. if I want to start a business, I can, there should be no government to tell me how to run my business
yeah.
or how to limit me,
right?
And so of course this has created a big backlash and mise en question, you know, people putting in question this ideology and saying, well, is this really what's best for the States? Is it what's best for the world?
But you know, I feel like the world doesn't mind as such that it's like a high ideal and that America is like going for it. But there's something else that at the university we came across this idea of manifest destiny.
Yeah.
You know, you're aware, you must be aware of this, the idea, and it's the sort of the idea that America, in its push to expand into the west of the continent,
yes.
and to unite the entire continent, as unlike Europe, which was very divided and lots of little countries fighting against each other, America would be a continent-sized nation united together
yep.
under one ideology, one dream. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in order to try and make that happen, I don't know how it came about. Maybe it was the sort of ideals of the religious people who'd sort of set up communities there or something.
I think that definitely influenced it.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's only a question of religion. I mean, I think that of course, those religions... what's ironic is that lots of the people who immigrated to the United States in the 17th century
yeah.
were people who were fleeing countries
right.
where they couldn't practice their religion.
Yeah.
And so already it's a continent of outsiders, even if those people have since set up their own kind of dictatorships in their own way.
Yeah.
The people who first arrived were these outsiders. And so they said to themselves, you know, we're going to create a new society. So
right.
ever since the beginning, like with the pilgrims, there was this idea that we're starting anew. This old,
right.
always idea of new world was very important.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I see. So it's a sort of it's like a project. And that's, yeah. But in that sense of people being outsiders, there's the idea that they were somehow in resistance to the rest of the world. It's like us against the world almost. But the world were both the ones that you compared yourself against, like we want to be different to Europe, for example.
Yeah.
But also the audience for America, because you were like, hey, look at us. you know, you like needed the eyes of the world to like be on America in order to, you know,
but I don't know how much of that was the states saying come look at us, or how much the world wanted to look at the states. I think it's a mix. It's both, but I don't know why there's such a fascination with the United States. It's interesting living abroad, and you know, being, I have this joke where I say that when I grew up in New York, I thought that New York was the center of the world. Now that I live abroad, I know it's true.
Yeah,
because it's weird that I grew up near New York, and you think like, well, you know, it's an important place, but I didn't think it was like really, because
culturally important.
Culturally important, yeah.
I mean, in terms of the
like fashion, like, but fashion, not only clothing, but just what's hip, what's, I mean, the states in general, out in New York and LA, you know, are the two big hubs, like LA, especially for the movie machine.
Yeah,
but it's
I mean, a lot of music came out of New York, and a lot of just culture. It's just this place that produces all this culture. And the
where I said the kind of the states is an experiment, I think New York is the epitome of that.
Yeah.
Where New York was the city to receive the most amount of diversity as far as immigration.
Yeah.
And so it became this city that kind of represented this melting pot experiment.
Right.
And I think that's kind of why it's always on the world looks at New York for that reason.
So I'm guessing, right, that you going for this sort of America is a nation of all the other nations in the world approach.
Yeah.
What's the American dream for you? Because I reckon there's two slightly different takes on the American dream. I might be wrong, but I think it's roughly two takes on the idea of it, and I think they sort of correspond with the Democrats and the Republicans as well, and the sort of left right spectrum that you get in the states. So I think the two versions are, one of them is the American dream is something that anyone can achieve. Doesn't matter who you are, what your background, anyone can make it to the top.
Yeah.
And the top spot being, of course, the president, that anyone can actually go from the gutter to the stars, and that we all start on a level playing field.
Yeah,
right.
That's the ideal.
Yeah. And then the other one is the sort of meritocracy idea, that that instead of it starting at a level spot at the bottom, the ground level, it's more like the bar is set at the top, and that if you can reach this point in the top, then you deserve everything that comes as a reward, and screw all the people at the bottom.
Yeah.
They're just not working hard enough, or they don't have the qualities necessary
to succeed.
Yeah, and it's all about working hard and being aspirational and being completely positive and totally libertarian. And the cream will rise to the top, and we'll get the best of the best.
Yeah.
The American Eagle idea of the sort of burgeoning, strong and dynamic sort of force that is the standard. And I think the Republicans have that idea because they don't believe in, like, you know, welfare programs and so on, and they want, you know, maybe it suits the rich class too, who are already at that level. And then the Democrats are more about equal opportunities and helping people achieve equal status, you know. What do you think you're more of the Democrat side?
I definitely think I'm more the Democrat side. I also think that in some way you explained the whole of American history with those two phrases. And since I think the states was built on the first ideal.
Right.
And the reality today is the second ideal.
Okay.
So I think that's interesting that you said those two, because it's kind of like where the original idea came from and the results. Right. 40 years later.
Yeah.
The result of that and how that's been deformed.
Yeah, because I suppose in the movement west and the struggle to populate against all odds, there was the frontiers that had to be crossed. You know, the geographical ones, like the big rivers and the great plains and the mountain ranges and all that stuff, to populate the entire country, and the Native Americans, you know, to defend themselves against them, and the civil war and things that nearly tore the country apart, and border issues with the Spanish and Mexico and stuff like that. That in order to survive all of that stuff, you did have to be the best, and that process did, you know, cut out the weaker ones, and the only the strong survived. And that was like the sort of marching call, you know, in the push to west, that that people died on the route and the best survived, you know. Yeah. But yeah, nowadays it's so diverse that you know, you've got to go with the more left wing idea that anyone could make it. But it's interesting, the two things. Would you? How would you? Oh, another difficult question for you. If you, you've got up to three words, which three words would you use to basically sum up the United States? You've got up to, one, two, or three words. It's up to you. And if you, you can be clever and create compound words,
yeah,
which can multi, you can multiply the number of words you can employ.
Hmm.
I think you said freedom before.
Promise of freedom.
Hmm. So it's a promise.
Yeah.
You're definitely going to get it.
Yeah. Well, we don't know if it's a fake promise. If it's, oh, okay. If it's a promise that will not necessarily live up to its promise.
Yeah.
But that I think is kind of the motto.
Wow. That's good. That's it's positive. It's idealistic, but it's certainly entertaining.
No, but that's what we're attracted to, I think.
Right. Yeah.
We feel that that's, you know, the American dream is kind of this idea that if we go there, we're someone owes us that freedom.
Right. Yeah, because maybe there was that. That's built into the history too. That the idea of that this country is a wide expanse of land, and it's all open. It's you can have your plot of land.
It's like the best bit of advertisement anyone has ever done. It's just this America. Like America has always been thinking in advertising terms, I feel, right, and kind of like put up a sign in front of, you know, the door to the rest of the world saying, here is freedom. This is the best way to live.
It's just like a huge real estate advert.
Yeah. And that's what I should promise in the sense that, like, as an advertising...
Yeah, a slogan.
A slogan is a promise. And right, it's just like, well, you can believe it or not, but you have to test the merchandise to actually know,
right,
if it's the promise is kept or not.
Very interesting. I was going to say, actually, that is there such a thing, in fact, as freedom? Like, what is it, and does it actually exist? No, and
that's what's ironic about it, is that it's not clear at all what that means. And and it's this word that in the States is thrown around a lot, especially when it comes to politics, and we don't really know what it means. I think everyone interprets it in different ways. I think the businessman interprets it as a meaning, no one's going to tell me that I can't exploit my workers, or no one's going to tell me that I can't make $5 billion a year. And you know, other people take it as you know, I can hop in my car and drive across from ocean to ocean and not have anyone bug me.
Or I can go to Starbucks with a gun on my belt, like a machine gun on my belt or something.
And that's my right.
Yeah, and that's my right, and therefore I will exercise it.
Yeah.
But in
positive, you know, I don't want to paint only dark pictures, but in a positive way, it's like, you know, I can choose where I want to live. I can choose the school I want to go to, what products I'm going to buy, what restaurant I'm going to go to. I can talk about the government and not fear prison. So, you know, this is part of the promise as well. And whether, you know, for most of that, I would say it's, you know, pretty true in that regard. But, you know, there's always this dark side that shows that it's not always true.
Yeah. I do get the sense whenever I go to America, or I'm just in connected to it, you know, I always do get that feeling that there is a sort of, hey, you know, anything's possible. There's an enterprising sort of vibe about the place. Whereas you go to some other places and you feel like, no, it's closed now. This place is, you know, like some places you go to, it's just like, you feel like a fairly restricted sort of view. But in America it's more like, hey, yeah, let's just do it, you know. Let's just do it right now here. Anything will you can,
and it will work.
Yeah that's
positive,
just this attitude. Sort of gung-ho kind of positivity. That's right. But I was thinking about just the idea of freedom, and in fact in an abstract sense, there is no such thing as freedom, because there's always some restriction to freedom. Even the fact that, you know, we're imposed upon by laws of nature and laws of physics, so there isn't true freedom there. If you're just left out in a field, you know, that's not really freedom, because you're pretty restricted by needing to survive and breathe and the elements and all that stuff. So you know, there's no real freedom. We're restricted within the sort of confines of the laws of physics and the universe.
Yep.
So it's definitely a sort of relative concept, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, and that's what's funny is that, like, as I said before, it's just like everyone, it is vague.
Yeah.
And it's, and it feels like there's a paradox within the word even.
Yeah.
You know, like, as you said, like, total freedom is not free at all. You know, you might be stranded if you're totally free.
Yeah.
And so that's just interesting to see, like, all these people on this one continent who has all the, who have all these different interpretations of this one word.
And you see that even, I think, in some of the wording of the Constitution, like the Second Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I studied this in the semester at university, so... you know, that's why I know it. Otherwise, I wouldn't know. I don't think most English people know about different amendments of the U.S. Constitution.
Well, it's normal. I don't know different parts of the...
I think I can quote the Second Amendment of the Constitution. It goes, a well-regulated militia for the protection of... No, a well-regulated militia for the protection of citizens, the right of which shall not be infringed. Something mm-hmm. like that. A well-regulated militia with the right to bear arms of which will not be infringed. Something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's actually quite contradictory because you've got the right to bear arms will not be infringed
yeah.
on one end. And at the other end, you've got a well-regulated militia.
Yeah.
So, like, it clearly shows, even in the wording of the Constitution, that some regulation is a good idea.
Yeah.
And yet, at the same time, people should... be given the right to have guns,
yeah.
but then that should be well regulated.
But I also think that it's like a weird amendment because the gun situation in the 18th century is so different than what it is today.
Yeah.
And also just even their situation, they probably needed to defend that, right? Because they were in the middle of a revolution with the British,
yeah.
where the British were telling them that you can't have guns because, you know, and so the Americans, of course, wanted to defend their right to have guns because that was their means to get yeah. independence.
Yeah.
And so that situation, you have to put it in that political and historical context.
They had no government.
Yeah.
When the thing was written, there was no government. The only government they had was an oppressive colonial regime.
Yeah.
The English, so they actually had no government. So written into the Constitution is the idea that the citizens should have arms in order to protect themselves against the government,
yep.
Against marauding foreign forces. Nowadays, people say protection against crime.
Yep.
But I think, I mean, maybe that was in there too, that people needed guns to as hunting, for hunting and also to defend their homes and Native Americans.
Sure,
as well.
And then, but you also have to think about the difference in gun technology between 1776 and 2014 is quite different.
Yes, absolutely. And a semi-automatic military grade assault rifle is not really what they had in mind when
no,
they talked about a well-regulated
so.
Militia.
All
right, that's the gun situation
yep.
sorted. Good. What we're doing in this episode is going through a list of pretty much everything in American history. That's what I'd like to cover in this episode. We're already 27 minutes in, and we've pretty much dealt with aspects of the Constitution, some of the early days, but we're going to go through the rest of... American history, and we're going to try and squeeze it all into one episode of Luke's English Podcast. So the idea is that listening to this episode, not only will you get to listen to two people talking about subjects in a fairly advanced way, fairly complex stuff, but also you'll get to know some of the basics of American history and American politics and culture.
I don't know about that.
That's the high-minded ideal that I'm using in this episode. I think it's very appropriate, considering this is an episode about America, that I should be overly ambitious and maybe even idealistic about the approach to doing this episode.
That's your freedom.
That's my freedom. I'm just expressing the right to the freedom that is that obviously is well-regulated, but that I have as part of my constitutional rights. Right, so George Washington set up the country and all that, Constitution, founding mm-hmm. fathers and stuff. We talked a bit about the colonial war and how that affected gun control issues. North-South, there was like a civil war in the States.
There was.
Lincoln,
yeah.
Of course.
You can call him Nicklin.
Yeah, I might call him Nicklin as well. I won't. But he was quite instrumental in that period as well. What do you know about the Civil War? Did you study that at school?
I did. Well, yeah, we studied American history, and yeah, how much of that I remember is another story. But the Civil War is was kind of a pretty important turning point, because there was always, well, tension between the North and the South, and this idea. I guess what's interesting is that when the United States was founded, there were kind of two ideologies, kind of, and the further along in history the United States advanced, the more this kind of split was getting more and more apparent. And it was kind of like this very northern idea, which is very industrial, city-based economy and lifestyle, compared to the southern, rural, more traditional,
agricultural
society. And that being held up as the ideal, and the clash came about finally in a war in 1861. I mean, and of course we talk about in our history books often that the main source of this conflict was the issue of slaves. And of course I think that's true, but I also think that there was a very heavy economic difference. And I think, well, of course, slavery is attached, was very important to the Southern lifestyle, and way of making money.
The whole economy based on it.
I was based on it.
And basically, the South would just lose large amounts of wealth as a result of slavery being abolished.
And then so the South was very scared about being economically dependent on the industrial North.
Right. And did that happen? Did it actually turn out like that?
I don't... That the South...
South was sort of like, you know, weak and dependent on the North.
I don't know. That question is... I don't think I know enough to be able to say what the result was.
Well, if we look at the North and South of the States, you know, generally the sort of from the mid to the East Coast, isn't it? Something like that. It's not exactly South... It's not like a perfect line.
No, but I don't think if you're wanting to know if I feel that there's a difference today, no, I don't think there's much of a difference.
I mean,
difference.
There's a bit of difference in culture. You get the sense that people in the South are different, their accents are different, and their outlook on life is a bit different. But you don't get a sense that, like, you know, in the South there's more poverty than there is in the North or anything like that.
Yeah, I think there is.
There is, yeah. Okay.
I think there's more wealth in the North still.
Yeah.
You know, you have pretty major cities that are quite wealthy. You know, I'm thinking of New York, Philadelphia, Boston, D.C.
Yeah.
But of course, they all have more poor neighborhoods in all those cities.
Like Detroit and stuff.
Yeah, well, that's already starting to get west. I mean, Detroit, Detroit is today, well, where it's always been, in the Civil War. That wasn't even really
involved.
It was too far west.
Right, I see. Not fully developed.
Yeah.
Yes.
So no, those places didn't even exist yet. Pretty much, you know, in the American psyche, when it came to the Civil War. So what I'm saying is that today those cities in the South are, yeah, there is this, I think, still general and very general difference of the North, you know, of wealth. And I think it's still more towards the North.
Right.
But I don't think that hurts the South today. But I'm coming from the North, so I don't know.
Okay. All right. So, I mean, I think there is a bit of a North-South divide, but it's not necessarily that obvious.
No, I don't think it's that obvious.
Other than just the way that people might behave and stuff like that. Okay. So slavery was obviously abolished. Big step. We don't see that it harmed the South that much. It must have done in the early years, but it's not like a long-lasting sort of damage. Mm-hmm. And there's no resentment, is there, these days between the North and the South?
Yeah, there's still stuff. I don't know if it's resentment or... but I think there's still some cliches that each of them have of the other. Like, I think the problem of the North is that, you know, people often hear a southern accent and think the person is just not that bright.
I'm from the South and I speak like this.
Yeah, kind of that automatically they're less intelligent and that they're racist or whatever.
Yes, the sort of racist kind of Forrest Gump kind of thing.
Yeah.
Life is like a box, like a box of chocolates.
Yeah. And I think the people from the South think the people from the North are pretentious or stupid in their own way, superficial or...
Yeah, it's exactly the same as most divides in other countries. Yeah, like between the North and South of England, we've got the same thing. And North and South of Italy, I believe. North and South of France.
France as well.
And plenty of other places too. Okay, so it's pretty, you know, the same kind of thing. It's funny, isn't it, how civilizations sort of like... They have similar patterns of behavior. It's just like tribalism or something like that. Okay, so what about... I was going to just ask you about what are the worst things, in your opinion, in US, in American history? The things that you think that American people could be ashamed of in terms of their history with the eyes of the world on them?
I think some of the worst things? I think their foreign policy.
Yeah.
Especially in the second half of the 20th century. In general already, but especially... Yeah, I'd say especially in the second half of the 20th century, in the wake of World War II, where the United States really kind of saw themselves as the ultimate power and abused it, and became a country of scared people and paranoid people, and kind of playing the policeman of the world and thinking that they had the right to. And they still do, but especially in the second half of the 20th century, that's when it really started.
So from that point where slavery was abolished and the North and South sort of made up and all that stuff, and you got America as a you know, the borders had been drawn, the lines had been drawn and stuff, and basically the place just became more and more prosperous, didn't it? With natural resources like the oil fields and development, and then later on industrialization.
That was a major thing.
The railroads and the development of the big cities.
Well, they realized that they had a whole continent to use, and they managed to bring the two coasts together with a transcontinental railroad, and started to really exploit the potential of the country.
Yeah, and it paid off because this American dream or the idea of manifest destiny that it was like, you know. A strong motivation to keep pushing, and also that idea of the frontier thing, you know, I mentioned of getting across the physical frontiers, but then there's that idea that the frontier spirit remained, and it was like about breaking other boundaries, making progress, you know, in society. The whole idea that society was moving in a direction, and ultimately that leading to things like the space race and putting a man on the moon, and then, you know, advances in science and other things like that. So how did I get onto that? Why did I just mention that?
Because we're talking about what I think is the worst part about human history. American history.
And the foreign policy.
Foreign policy.
That's right. And it coming from maybe the idea of the manifest destiny that the US has like a sort of God-given right to. It believed so much in the democratic system, the capitalist system, that it thought that this was the right thing
for everyone.
Yeah, exactly. So that maybe explains some of the interventionist sort of things that happened in South America and
all over the world. I mean, South America and Asia, in Africa, and so it's in the Middle East especially. So yeah, they were able to stick their nose into most people's business.
It's very interesting though, after World War II, where America was dragged into the conflict by the attack on Pearl Harbor, Hitler declaring war on the States and all that stuff, and then the campaign in Europe and the Pacific campaign, which ultimately was a victory of American democratic capitalism over the extremism of fascism. Imperialism and German and Italian, well, German fascism. But then communism was the sort of the threat that came out of the World War II for the Americans. Yep. It was like two big blocks, communist and capitalist, competing on pretty similar terms.
Yep.
And you mentioned this led to this fear that went through American society after the war.
Well, the American government fabricated their worst enemy, their arch nemesis. And when the USSR had the capacity to drop an atomic bomb on the States, all of a sudden they became paranoid that they would, and even though the United States spent much more and had many more weapons than the USSR ever did, the United States government managed to fabricate this fear, this constant fear, and really have the whole population pretty much on edge for 40 years.
Very weird period, because if you look at the States in the 50s, it's all diners and like awesome looking cars.
Yep.
And it's all sort of waitresses on roller skates, and it's rock and roll and this, and bowling alleys and stuff, and this like drive-in movie theaters and all that stuff, popcorn and everything. And it's this sort of Disneyland kind of universe that you were living in, and yet there was this dark threat of some sort of communists. Yeah, the communists, the others, exactly. Yeah. You see it in a lot of American movies from the 50s. Well,
all the like science fiction movies.
Yeah.
It was just a metaphor for the others, the Russians, the communists,
the
people who are not like you and sort who are coming to invade and...
Yeah, like Mars Attacks, you know, those old 50s movies about alien spaceships coming and attacking. Yeah, it was all just about a fear of communism.
Yeah.
So that I guess, finally came to an end with the Berlin Wall going down. But before that, we had various things going on. Kennedy assassination, of course, which still to me is a huge mystery.
Yeah.
Obviously, the official story goes that Lee Harvey Oswald was like a communist, basically. Mm-hmm. I don't know what
the theory on him was. I don't know if they said that he was just a communist or what.
But it's very fishy.
Everything is fishy about that. I mean, just the whole thing stinks of fish.
And
I just don't know how. I guess like the American people are just like shrug their shoulders, just like, okay, just another total mystery that we're never going to know.
I don't know. I don't think the American people have. I think that there are enough people in the States who are suspicious of that event.
I think most people are. So
yeah.
But
I don't think anyone's bought it, right?
I don't think anyone, but it's amazing. How can you have a whole country just saying, okay, I don't believe that story, and they just go on with their lives. They don't do anything about it. I don't know what you can do.
I think the story was that Lee Harvey Oswald was a sort of lone loser guy who was maybe a bit, you know, not very well. And he spent time in Russia, or he was a member of the Communist Party or something like that. And for some reason, he decides to kill the president. Yeah. And he goes up to the book depository tower and he shoots him twice, which is... some of the suspicious things are the fact that it seems it would have been pretty difficult for him to shoot him. Twice like that. And also you see the footage of when the president gets shot, his body moves in a direction that you don't expect if the bullets are coming from over his shoulder.
Yeah.
He's moving away from Oswald in his car. The bullets are apparently coming from just over his right shoulder. And the first one hits him in the throat, and you see him putting his hands up to his throat, and he's leaning forwards. The next one hits him in the head, and it flings his head backwards and to the left.
Yeah.
And you see, obviously, his head, you know, the bullet hits his head, and it's very graphic.
Yeah, it is pretty graphic.
Something that many Americans would have seen is like a horrible sort of moment. You can't not see it.
Yeah.
The moment where, you know, he's a handsome guy and an icon, such a brutal moment.
Yeah.
But the weird thing is the movement of his body that goes back like that.
It seems like he wasn't working alone. I mean, there's so many different things. It seems fishy from A to Z, because it just seems like he was a puppet, that he wasn't even the person, that he just, the government found someone.
And the fact that he was arrested quite quickly afterwards.
And then
he was assassinated by a mafia guy.
Yeah.
A guy who owned like a bar, some low level mafia dude who'd basically been given the job of shooting Oswald, and the reason that was given why Jack Ruby shot him, he said that he didn't want Jackie Kennedy to have to go through he didn't want Jackie Kennedy to have to go through such a difficult trial. She didn't want, you know, it was, she was doing it for Jackie.
Yeah.
Because you know, he didn't want her to go through a very traumatic trial.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
An excuse of a fifth grader.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I'm sorry, my dog ate my homework. it's that level kind of thing. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. In fact, I definitely don't agree with a lot of those, and I find them very, very, very dodgy indeed. But I have to say there's something quite strange about the Kennedy situation. And I mean, comedians like Bill Hicks talk about it, that, you know, that all presidents now, when they get the job, when they first, on their first day, they basically are led into a dark room with a bunch of guys in black suits in the dark, and they're all smoking cigars, and they put on a movie. There's the screen, and they start the film, and it's just a slow motion footage of the Kennedy assassination, and they turn it off, and they just turn back to him and go, any questions? You know, as if to say, look, don't mess with us.
Yeah.
That's the sort of paranoid idea, that there's a bunch of shadowy figures that are running everything in the US.
Yeah.
I don't really know about that, but it's definitely weird. After that, there was the sort of civil rights situation.
Mm-hmm.
The civil rights movement, the black equality sort of situation, and the hippie movement with the Woodstock Music Festival.
Mm-hmm.
How do you sort of view the 60s and the music and the civil unrest?
Well, I think there were kind of different movements happening that kind of all converged in the 60s, and I think it was being fed up with this Cold War idealism that we have to live in fear, and I think it was kind of this backlash of like, no, love is there, and this kind of it was a generation where they were trying to put love as an ideal rather than fear. And of course, there was this also, what is freedom? I think this was kind of this reassessment of what America is. And they were trying to put that in question and trying to push freedom to another limit. Mm. And of course, and this was a, you know, very free way of life, sexually speaking, drug-wise, it was just really trying to seek out what's beyond what's known and what we've always done before.
Yeah.
And trying to throw away the generations of this kind of traditional lifestyle.
Yeah, I think that they sort of, the hippies and the beatniks, took hold of this idea, this one strand of the American thing, which is just freedom, and they've just pushed it to the limit, you know. Almost, it's almost sort of like the last ditched attempt at holding on to the idea of freedom. I feel like there's a tragic sense to that whole hippie movement, which is a dark, sort of disappointing, melancholic side to it.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that in the 70s with people like Hunter S. Thompson.
Yeah.
And the beat writers are actually quite sort of tragic characters.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them are junkies and they're degenerate at the end. And, and I mean, Thompson was just an incredible force in American writing. But that sort of anger that he had, the fear and loathing that he experienced, just seeing this idea, it was like the moment where the innocence just sort of turned into cynicism and the naive, reality.
The naive aspect also, because there was this kind of, we can do anything, which is, you know, whether you think so or not, you know, it kind of had this double-edged sword where it was kind of people were pushing things to the limit, anything is possible, but there's also danger there.
Yeah.
And I think that the kind of Hunter S. Thompson says it very well. It's kind of like you see this wave going and then it finally breaks at a point.
There was that moment in Haight Ashbury in 1966, 1967 or whatever, that moment where the hippie dream reached its peak. There was probably one hippie, you know, right at the peak of it, who took an acid trip in, like, you know, September 1967 or something, and he reached the highest that anyone has ever got. But it's all been downhill from then on. But it's definitely fascinating. I had something really interesting to say about that, and I can't remember what it is now. Oh, it just made me think of the book Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and the idea that these two guys went looking for the American dream, and almost like they were sort of they knew that it was over, and they wanted to have a proper look.
Well, and of course they chose
Las Vegas,
which is kind of also a funny place because it's really the American dream to an extreme.
Yeah.
It's just, we can do anything. any, you know, you want to eat at any hour of the day, there's going to be food. You want to drink all that you want in excess. It's a city of excess.
Yeah.
And so that's why they chose to go there. It's because it's a strange kind of beast of the American dream, like brainchild.
I feel like they could equally have gone to Disneyland.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same kind of thing. Like for me, Las Vegas is basically adult Disneyland.
It's adult Disneyland. Yeah.
And so they went there and they took all these psychedelic drugs as a way of sort of squeeze, you know, cleaning the third eye almost,
yeah,
to have a proper look at what America was. And it's like the ugly, dark heart of, yeah, of American culture, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So that's
nothing is real. Nothing is authentic. Everything is new. Fabricate, you know, and you can go anywhere in the world that you want to. You can fulfill any dream,
and yet there's nothing.
But nothing is real.
It's sort of nihilistic or something like that. Yeah, and the hippies sort of failed in a way because, again, what Hunter S. Thompson says in that book, that they made the mistake that thinking that they could buy enlightenment from like a $5 acid trip.
Yeah.
That it all, you know, Timothy Leary thought that it was a consciousness revolution, a revolution of the mind, and that a new way of thinking, a different, you know, sort of paradigm was going to exist, but it was all just bullshit because they were high.
Yeah,
you know, and it all turned bad. You know, a lot of those people ended up.
But I think hooked. I think the ideal is correct. I think the way they decided to go about it was where they messed up.
It ended up in debauchery and excess, yeah, and hard drugs, yeah, and that was really tough. And the drug scene after that became a really nasty street scene where, you know, a lot of people were suffering from it rather than it being a liberating thing.
Becoming addicted and...
Yeah, all that stuff. Okay, so it's sort of getting a bit heavy, isn't it, with all of this stuff about the death of the American dream and stuff. And I did ask you before about what you thought would be the worst thing about the States, but it's not all negative, of course, because, I mean, you know, personally, I just think the States is an incredible place.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the things that I, you know, really, really like have come from America, like, for example, you know, the music and the jazz and blues and all the derivatives, you know, of soul and funk and rock and roll and all that stuff and hip hop. And also the movies and the clothing and loads of things.
Yeah.
For you, what would you say is the best thing? The thing that you're really proud that America has done or given to the world?
Well, proud. I don't think this is necessarily the most well known thing about the States, but I'm probably one of the things I'm most proud of is the national park system. Because the United States had in front of them this giant landscape. And because the United States was one of the first industrialized nations, they saw in the 19th century this risk that industry can really destroy the entire environment. Mm. And they realized also that they had many places in the United States that are very unique, very beautiful.
Yeah.
And that because they were the first country to have this industrial monster sweep across a continent, they were also the first to say, whoa, wait, hold on, this place should be spared.
Right.
And that system that they put in place to defend, that this idea was never put in place before, I think, in any other country, where the government says, this spot of land you cannot touch, you cannot grow anything.
Oh, right.
This is protected in its nature. And it's illegal to hunt. It's illegal to grow anything. This will be preserved in its natural environment.
Was that the New Deal? Was that part of that?
No.
No. Okay.
No.
All right.
This is independent because it wasn't necessarily one. It was an ongoing process, but the first national park in the world is Yellowstone National Park.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's a place, and Yosemite was right after. Yosemite might be the first protected place in the world, and Yellowstone the first official national park.
Nothing can be done there. It's like a huge sort of...
it's a reserve.
Yeah.
It's no one can mine here. No one can log. You know, it's a place that will be defended. And... I saw a documentary about it recently about the history of the national park system, and it wasn't easy because lots of people, you know, like cow herders,
yeah,
you know, started to just go over the border of the national park, and you know, and so there had to be like they had to set up a system of rangers.
I was going to say, how did they? You say it's a place that would be defended. What would defend it? Like bears, like teams of bears,
teams of bears and wolves,
and
eagles would gouge out people's eyes.
Yeah, okay, that's like the way it's defended by elk, things like that.
Well, they set up eventually. They had to set up this kind of police force. National parks, which eventually became the Rangers.
Rangers.
Yeah.
They sound so cool.
Yeah, they do
the
sound
Rangers.
Cool.
The Rangers.
It's a cool job.
Have there been any movies about Rangers?
I don't think so.
Someone needs to make that film.
They should. It must be an exciting... Yeah, you could probably get lots of great stories out of it.
So a ranger would be like a guy who sort of works in a national park.
Yep.
He's sort of a bit of a cowboy type guy, maybe.
Like a mix between a cowboy and a cop.
Yeah, that's a good mix for a film.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, imagine this situation, okay? It's like a sort of family drama.
Mm-hmm.
It was a coming of age story, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
From generation to generation. They'd been rangers in the family. And it's like Tommy Lee Jones.
He has to be like the grandfather.
Tommy Lee Jones is the grandfather. He's still doing the work.
Yeah.
And he carries a Smith & Wesson and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then you've got Matthew McConaughey.
His son.
Who's his son.
Yeah.
And then maybe his son is like, who's that guy who was in Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull?
Oh, I haven't seen that one.
He's the one who really wants to be taken seriously as an actor. He was in the first Transformers film. You don't know who I'm talking about.
You're citing
Shia LaBeouf.
Okay.
You know him?
No.
You don't know him?
Probably I know his face.
Okay, you will know his face, but yeah. Maybe not Shia LaBeouf because he's terrible.
Elijah Wood?
No,
Who always looks young?
No, we need someone who's like a sort of a bit of a big star, young star, but like fitting that hillbilly kind of ranger, cowboy, cop kind of mold.
Yeah, would have been Val Kilmer 30 years ago.
Val Kilmer could be in the film.
Yeah.
Like a sort of...
He could be... He's definitely in this universe.
Val Kilmer could be in it as a sort of, the role that's going to rescue his career.
Yeah.
This is an Oscar-winning film that we're dealing with here.
Yeah.
We just need the younger role, and we need Amy Adams has to be in this film.
Yeah, definitely.
Amy Adams is like, you know, the Matthew McConaughey sort of love interest.
Yeah.
But then there has to be a younger one as well, like, I don't know, someone from the Harry Potter universe or...
Yeah, the British girl who will be a British ninja.
Emma Watson. Yeah, she would be doing her American accent.
American accent, and she will win an Oscar because she does the American accent very well.
Okay, Emma Watson in there.
There has to be something that gets handed down to the generation, like a buffalo horn or something like that. That Tommy Lee Jones, you know, he like had to defend a baby boy from a buffalo.
And like him and Matthew McConaughey go out on like a Rangers like sort of expedition where they've got to like free a wolf from a fence or something.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, they're going out and Tommy Lee Jones is going, did I ever tell you about the time when I had to free a wolf from a fence up in the north end of the range? And Matthew McConaughey's like, you know, just responding in the way that he would. I think that's going to be
This speech comes right after like a dangerous moment that Tommy Lee Jones almost got bitten by a rattlesnake or something like that.
Right.
You know, and Matthew McConaughey saved his life, and that's when sprouted this conversation because Tommy Lee Jones saw death.
It's like a bonding moment between father and son.
Yeah.
He was a father. He was a son and a father. He suddenly knew what it was like to be a father.
I think the name of this film would be Home on the Range.
Home on the Range. Cinemas near you from Friday. Amy Adams from Academy Award nominee Matthew McConaughey. Yeah. Who would be the writer-director of that? It's got to be from writer, director, whoever. Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, Clint Eastwood. I'm thinking Brokeback Mountain with Ang Lee.
No, it's a Clint Eastwood film.
Yeah, probably would be.
Home on the Range. And then Clint Eastwood is in the movie. He's Tommy Lee Jones's dad.
Yeah, he's the great-grandfather.
Yeah, and he's like, what would Clint Eastwood say in this film? I guess you're going to get that buffalo out of that fence. Yeah, something like that.
I think he would just be like too old and just be like, someone's got to change me. kind of.
Yeah, I just shit my pants again, Maud. All right, so we were saying that the national parks is a thing to be proud of.
Yep.
And the rangers, the cool rangers who patrol the parks.
Who defended it.
Okay, all right.
And then, of course, the other thing I think is a very wonderful contribution of American society, and I think that will probably be the thing that remains is entertainment.
Yeah.
As you were saying, it's just the wealth and variety of musical influence and culture, and then movies and television and comedy, and it's just, it was just this bubbling of entertainment, of pop culture.
Yeah, and lots of good car chases.
Lots of good car chases.
Really
and
good.
Heists.
Yeah, like bank robberies gone wrong.
Oh, yeah.
Where there's like a guy on the floor with his hands down, and he's going to try and be a hero.
Yeah.
You know.
And there's a red button somewhere that he should not touch.
That's right. Yeah. Or there's like a countdown timer for a bomb.
Yeah.
And he's got to try and defuse the bomb in just 10 seconds, God damn it. You know, it's a Bruce Willis film.
And there are wires that should not be crossed.
Yeah. And this is Bruce Willis. He's got to cut through all the wires in a bomb.
Yeah.
And he's just a cop from New York. And he's like, God, how did I get into this shit?
Again.
Yeah. Okay.
For the 16th time.
And he's only there because he wanted to spend Christmas with his ex-wife.
Yeah.
Hey, come on over. We'll hang out and have a few laughs. And he's like trying to defuse a bomb.
Yeah. And his son is crying. And the mother... His ex-wife's mother is on the phone saying, you have to be here right now. Your son is disappointed with you.
It's like, how did all this shit happen on the same weekend?
It's always on the same weekend. And it's always Christmas weekend. Yeah.
How did so much shit happen on Christmas weekend? Okay. I was going to go through other parts of American history, but I think that we may have sort of dealt with it all. Nixon and the Watergate scandal in the sort of early to mid-70s. Richard Nixon, of course, found to be at the heart of a big corruption scandal where he was tapping the phones and spying on his rivals at the Democrat headquarters. And it turned out that he'd lied and all this stuff, and he resigned. So loss of faith in the administration, I think, is basically what that means. Again, sort of fueling the sort of fire of the alternative in America, which ended up sort of going into a slightly conspiracy theory kind of crackpot direction, the hippies sort of thing, I think. In one way, and in the other way, the hippie thing just fed into the entrepreneurialism and enterprising spirit in America, and you end up with people like Steve Jobs and other, like, you know, internet specialists who did Silicon Valley and the sort of idealistic and Steve Jobs definitely was all about, because he went to India and he meditated and he learned about Zen and all these sorts of things, and he applied that to American business, and you end up with a company like Apple, which has got this sort of minimalist, almost sort of Eastern kind of ethos.
Yeah,
you know, this sort of minimalist design, and it's just so user friendly. It's very Japanese.
Yeah, it is very Japanese.
Just the minimal, only the things you need, and nothing else, and purely efficient, and the standards are very, very high. And I think that came out of his experience of meditating and, in fact, taking acid, because he talks about that, and, you know, plenty of times, and it's in his biographies and things, that he actually used LSD as a sort of liberating idea for sort of coming up with new ideas and breaking boundaries in business and design and things like that. So in one sense, the hippie dream went a bit weird, but in the other sense, it's fed into the business aspect, didn't it? Reagan. What do you think of Ronald Reagan?
Well, also it's another period that I'm not such an expert on. Well, I'm not expert on any of this.
I seem to be the expert on America.
Yeah. I think you know more than because you studied it more recently.
Yeah, right? I mean, I had to teach it. That's the thing.
Ah, yeah.
So when you have to, and for my listeners out there, if you want to learn about English grammar or any subject. What you need to do is decide that you're going to teach that subject to a group of people in your job, and suddenly you will just...
When you're forced to be the specialist.
Yeah, you've got to be the most clued up person in the room, or at least a bit. And So yeah, it forced me to do lots of reading and thinking about the subject. So hopefully in this episode, we're getting to the grips with what America is all about. I hope that this could be a very useful episode. Certainly this is the sort of thing that my students have done this semester, compressed into probably what's going to be about an hour and 20, an hour and 30 minutes. It's quite a long episode, but I think there's plenty of content in here. Reagan was really all about, like, you're going to say something?
Well, yeah, I was just going to say that he's kind of a return to kind of conservative culture, and especially economically speaking, and kind of this like tight, hard fist mentality that was a counteraction against the 70s, like the 60s and the 70s, and becoming also stricter with the USSR and kind of bringing them to the breaking point, which culminated in the fall of the Berlin Wall right after his leaving office.
Didn't they? He developed he was the president during the Star Wars thing, which was like a missile defense system. Yes. So it's like, aha, up yours, Russia. You can't get us because we've got Star Wars.
Yeah.
And that maybe made Russia go, okay.
Yeah.
All right then.
Let's just end this.
Yeah.
Right,
let's just chill out. It's fine. No problem. Everything's okay. Honestly. So Bush era, of course, you know, after the economic sort of liberalism of Reagan, Bush sort of followed with a foreign policy thing, didn't he? George Bush the first, who did, you know, the first Iraq thing and the whole intervention in the Middle East, which we don't have time to go into, but I think since it's quite recent, I think most of the people have a basic idea. Certainly with the second Gulf War after Clinton, the George Bush
Jr.
Who, and what a president. I mean, what can you say about George Bush?
Probably one of the worst periods in American history.
Yeah, I think that the conservatives in America would tell you that this is the worst period, the Obama administration. But it seems that the rest of the world is not buying that. We still quite like Obama. We're kind of like, Obama's all right.
Yeah.
America, you don't like him anymore.
Yeah, it seems like he's disappointed.
Yeah.
That, you know, I mean, that's kind of also the risk of the angle he was taking, was like, I am the change. I am, you know, it's going to be different from now on. And when you kind of use that rhetoric and kind of make those promises, if you don't live up to it, you know, you're going to get people against you. And I think that's kind of what happened, generally speaking.
Yeah.
And, well, you know, he was kind of pinned against a Congress that was, you know, really refused to bow to anything that he proposed, and so he's not that popular.
So like when the president wants to make a decision, he has to get the Congress has to vote on it, and then if the Congress agrees with the bill that the president has introduced, then it gets made into a law. But if Congress is overwhelmingly Republican, in which is the case, and obviously Obama being a Democrat, that means that if they don't want to allow him to do anything, they can just block all of
which is what happened in the last few years.
They just refuse to vote on anything. And you end up with a stalemate where Obama's trying to push a whole program of nationalized healthcare, immigration reform, and basically the Republican-dominated Congress, with the influence of the Tea Party movement, is just completely refusing to play games. And as a result, Obama is forced to take executive action, bypassing Congress and just taking immediate unilateral decisions without getting the votes, just executive orders, which are a bit controversial, but every president has done them, apparently. The result is that the Republicans, the Tea Party Republicans, are all claiming that he's violating the Constitution by taking executive action.
Yep.
And so they think it's him. They're blaming him, saying, look at this, he's out of control, he's a tyrant. And Obama is blaming the Republicans, saying that we can't do anything, they're just blocking it. In fact, last year there was a shutdown.
Yep.
The American government stopped for a few weeks.
Yeah.
What a disaster that was. It was just like it just stopped running for a while. So George Bush, though, is a hilarious president.
Yeah.
Comedians like to make fun of him.
Yeah, because there was so much to make fun of him for.
Yeah.
And it just didn't make sense. It was just, it was absurd that this guy ever became president.
Yeah. Yeah, it's right. He just Well, guess I'm the president. I don't know how it happened, but
yeah, that was the thing. Like, he seemed the most clueless of how this happened.
Yeah, and he's like there going, "Well, you voted for me. Actually, you didn't.
You didn't. But here I am. Yeah. So let's do it."
There are lots of comics who do really good George Bush impressions.
Yeah.
Do you know a guy called Frank Caliendo?
No.
He's amazing, American impressionist.
Yeah.
And he does a really, really good George Bush. It's very, very funny indeed. George Bush is famous for his Bushisms, which are like mistakes and stupid things that he said.
Yeah.
The one he said, do you know what he said about France?
No.
He said, the thing about the French is they have no word for entrepreneur. criticizing the lack of entrepreneurial spirit.
Yeah.
But obviously it's a French word.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said things like, I think the man and the fish can coexist in the future. It's like the man and the fish can coexist, really. And lots of other stupid things.
Yeah.
So, all right, what's going to happen in the future then? Is it going to be like Back to the Future, the movie?
No.
Flying cars and hoverboards.
And someone having to run to save his parents.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to have to run to your parents.
Yeah, yeah, we are. There's not much of a pension system,
no,
is there?
No. It doesn't seem like... I think the United States is eventually going to lose power more and more slowly but surely.
Isn't China the number one...
I believe so, yeah.
I think it is now.
So I already think the tides have turned. You're talking about the future exactly...
Well, I guess part of the future in some areas of the States is that... They've just sort of gone, well, let's just smoke some weed and not worry about it. They've legalized marijuana in a few
many
states.
Many states, yeah.
Yeah.
Colorado.
Colorado, yeah.
Well, it's Colorado, Washington. Well, it's illegal in the state of California if you have a permit.
Right.
And apparently to get a permit, it's very easy.
You just say, I've got a bit of a head cold.
Yeah, I've got a stomach ache. And,
mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that part of the population of the states are like fine with the states not being the power.
Everyone's just going, maybe we shouldn't be, maybe we're okay, we're just get on with our lives and everything's all right. We don't need to have this gung-ho mentality and
all the time.
Yeah, it's just we're okay. We've got humor and we've got our culture and the things we love and all our sports. You know, it's like we're not really any different to like Australia or, you know, any other country. You know, we're just really into sport and we make kick-ass movies and we make good music and we're crazy.
Yeah,
you know, we're completely insane and we have like these weird musical acts like you know, like Katy Perry or like what's her name, Lady Gaga, and all this stuff.
Lady Gaga,
I mean, what's wrong with that? It's great.
Yeah. And that they're like, okay, well, we might be losing power, but that's fine. That's cool. It's a relief.
And in fact, really, like,
we'll just do our stuff.
China and America is fully invested in China anyway.
Yeah.
Because they've got like, you know, businesses running there and all that stuff. So all the sort of maybe the divides that we've had before are sort of not as important as the other economic ties.
Yeah, it seems things are blurring in that sense.
Yeah, I think it's one of those financial ties that are actually more important than geographical ones, and that one country's benefit is sort of the benefit of everyone else in a way. I don't know. Is that, you think so?
Well, I think that there's more. There's definitely more cross breeding here. I think many people are going to other countries and investing. So yeah, no, I think it's not so much a question of borders that much anymore. I think it's more a question of economics, as you said.
Yeah, okay, all right. Well, I think what's happened probably in this episode is that the ship has run adry. We've sailed across the Atlantic Ocean and we're just like, the ship has just hit the beach at where would we land? Cape Cod or something.
Cape Cod.
We've just onto the sand, just run aground. And here we are. We've arrived in America, and we've done our homework.
And we have no idea what's in front of us.
Yeah, maybe Native Americans.
We don't know.
Maybe McDonald's.
Well, probably both.
What should we do? As a Native American yourself,
mm-hmm.
You know, in a sense.
Very vague sense.
What should we do on our first day in the States now that we've arrived? What do you want to do?
I think we should hit the road.
Yeah.
Yeah. get in the car and start exploring.
What kind of car are we going to drive?
A 1957 Chevy.
Okay.
Cliche.
Yeah. All right. We're going to play rock and roll on the radio.
Yep.
And we're going
to
drive.
Rock and roll that doesn't even exist. Like, we'll listen to Beatles in the car.
Yeah. Okay. And we'll drive down Route 66.
Yeah.
And drink Coca-Cola and go surfing in California.
Yeah.
Okay. That sounds like a pretty good ending to the podcast.
Not bad.
Yeah.
At least there's sun there.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. There's sun. The beautiful girls. Pamela Anderson.
Yeah.
Although she's getting on. She's a bit old now, isn't she?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think I want to know the state of her breasts right now.
No. Let's keep them as they were in 1995.
Yeah.
When they were at their best.
At their peak.
Exactly. I think that's probably a fitting moment to bring this episode of the podcast to an end. And on balance, as it were, we've arrived at Pamela Anderson's breasts, which maybe
is kind of the end, where it should end.
It's the logical end point for all of American culture.
Yes, the story of America.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for guesting on the podcast, Sebastian.
Thanks for having me.
And I hope you don't mind being sort of quizzed on the US history like this.
Yeah, I'm strapped to a chair. You don't see
it. You've got no choice.
He strapped me to a chair.
Yeah, I forced him to explain and justify his entire nation. And I think that it came out all right in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With Pamela Anderson's breast.
Exactly. Okay. Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. I was going to say that I would put a picture of Pamela Anderson's breasts on teacherluke.co.uk. I don't think I need to stoop to that low level to try and persuade my listeners. Even the female listeners, I don't know if you're interested in that. You may not be. You may be. I don't know. But I'm not going to do that. But I would say go to teacherluke.co.uk and just visit the site. It's very nice. And leave your comments there. We'd both like to hear your responses to this episode.
And read them.
And read them as well. Exactly. Thanks very much for listening. Speak to you again very, very soon. But for now, it's goodbye. Bye. Bye. Bye.
Thanks again for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.